Hello, my name's Dave Emery, and this is Side 2 of For the Record program number 600, The Axis Revisited, Changing the Past and Controlling the Present. This program is being recorded on June 10th of the year 2007. We were taking a look at some of the fruits of the U.S. and other Western powers having sustained basically Italian fascism in power at the end of World War II. Those residual elements became our collaborating partners during the course of the Cold War, and even though they were anti-communist, they were also in the end anti-democratic and anti-American. And for veteran listeners, if the whole P2 thing seems a long time ago and far away, well, those same elements, the supersedes me related elements, figure in the uranium yellow cake forgery coming out of Niger, or I should say the forged documents concerning yellow cake uranium coming out of Niger. It was that forgery that was cited by the Bush administration as evidence that we had to go to war in Iraq, and it turns out that the genesis of this information, which was so greedily gobbled by the Bush administration, was none other than the super seize me milieu, or the seize me in this case, and that they began pushing this thesis right after September 11th. In past discussion of this, I have cited, among other things, the meeting at Mont Pelerin in Switzerland in the spring of 2002, as the war clouds were gathering. Ahmed Huber of the Bank Altaqua and Franz Schoenhuber, the SS officers of head of the German Republikaner Party, the aforementioned Gianfranco Fini, head of the Italian Fascist Party and Deputy Prime Minister of Italy, and the Foreign Minister of Italy, and Jean-Marie Le Pen, head of the French Fascist Party, the Front National. They met with an unnamed far-right American leader at an exclusive Swiss resort in the spring of 2002. I have ruminated about what significance that may have had for what took place later. I wonder if Iraq was the subject of discussion and how perhaps to lure the United States to its doom, politically and economically anyway, in Iraq. I have ruminated in the past about the U.S. falling into such a trap, not a trap which required a lot of guile, but rather a trap that was set by the old Axis by way of settling the score and assuming dominance on the international political and economic scene. Sadly, we underestimated, or at least those people in the United States of democratic instinct underestimated just how purposeful and long-sighted fascists in Italy, Japan, and Germany were. And they saw only the short-term anti-communist utility of these elements and forgot about the fact that we were going to have to deal with these people in the post-war period. I don't think they had any such illusions. I also should mention that I don't think the United States, I don't think it required a great deal of guile to lure the United States into Iraq. I've compared it with the guile necessary to set a pot of honey in the path of a marauding bear. But nonetheless, we should be aware of just how destructive that P2 supersedes me milieu continues to be. They're also involved with the renditions that have taken place in the indictment of CIA officers. So the whole supersedes me milieu evolved into the DSSA that we spoke about in For the Record 595, continues to be very much with us. In many broadcasts, we have spoken about the fact that in Japan, basically the same thing was done as in Italy and Germany. In order to fight the Cold War, in order to preserve an anti-communist status quo, fascist interests were simply laundered and put right back into power. They took off the uniforms, and with the exception of a few of the more obnoxious war criminals in their midst, they simply continued only with different uniforms. Some of the key bonds were economic in Japan as in Germany. The programs that we've done in and around the book Gold Warriors by the Seagraves are of particular importance in that regard. We're going to jump from Italy to Japan. We're going to jump from one of the Axis partners of the Tripartite Pact, Italy, to the other one, aside from Germany and Italy, Japan, right now. One of the things that's been taking place is that when Japanese Prime Minister Shinzo Abe himself, the grandson of someone deeply tied, former Prime Minister Tanaka, deeply tied to the powerful economic axis that lay at the root of Japanese fascism and which collaborated with like-minded elements in the United States, Shinzo Abe has presided over a sort of an academic reaction in Japan in which Japanese textbooks are being rewritten to erase some of the more embarrassing history, even when that history is quite well known. This is being accompanied also by simply an unwillingness on the part of officialdom in Japan to admit the obvious, such as the following from the New York Times from March 6th of 2007, this about Japanese refusal to apologize for their sex slaves during World War II, basically claiming that no such thing had taken place. This article is called No Apology for Sex Slavery. Japan's Prime Minister says it's by Martin Fackler, Dateline Tokyo, March 5th. It reads in part as follows. Prime Minister Shinzo Abe said Monday that Japan would refuse to comply if the United States Congress demanded an apology for his nation's use of foreign women as sexual slaves during World War II. Japan has already lobbied against a resolution under consideration in the House of Representatives that would call on Tokyo to take clear responsibility for its enslavement of some 200,000 mostly Korean and Chinese women, known euphemistically here as comfort women, unquote. Japan has apologized before and issued a major report in 1993, but there are widespread concerns that Mr. Abe and other conservative Japanese lawmakers may try to water down or reverse such admissions of guilt as part of a broader push to revise their nation's wartime history. Speaking in Parliament, Mr. Abe reiterated the position of conservative scholars here that Japanese officials and soldiers did not have a hand in forcing women into brothels, instead blaming any coercion on contractors used by Japan's military. Mr. Abe rejected testimony before a House committee by surviving victims who said they had been kidnapped by Japanese soldiers to serve in military brothels. He said, quote, testimony to the effect that there had been a hunt for comfort women is a complete fabrication, unquote. He also criticized the proposed House resolution, which blames Japanese authorities for the coercion, saying it, quote, was not based in objective fact and does not consider the Japanese government's measures so far. In the description for the Record 600, there will be a list of the many broadcasts dealing with Japanese fascism, its profound economic connections with powerful elements in this country, though the way those profound economic connections have in turn spawned profound political connections, the role of the Bush family in this particular concatenation. Those, however, will be in the description for the Record 600. Now, in addition to the fact that the Japanese Prime Minister himself is refusing to admit the obvious in this case, other blatant or other well-recognized aspects of Japanese World War II history are also being denied in their textbooks. Some weeks back, we took a look at a Japanese documentary film that was being made that denies the existence of the Rape of Nanking. Now, some Japanese textbooks are being rewritten to eliminate the Japanese Army's role in putting pressure on the residents of Okinawa to commit suicide en masse. Okinawa was one of the last major battles of World War II in the Pacific. It was on Japanese territory. It also took place on an island that was inhabited by people who were an ethnic subgroup of the Japanese population and had never fully assimilated. There were ethnic and linguistic differences. And because of that, the people of Okinawa were viewed by the Japanese imperialists and their associated military elements as inferior or, at the very least, rebellious. And they did not shed too many tears at the prospect of them being liquidated after the military defeat on Okinawa. This article is from the New York Times of Sunday, April 1st of 2007. It's headlined, Japan Revises Role in World War II Okinawa. Textbooks will no longer say Army ordered civilians to commit suicide as conflict ended. This was republished in the San Francisco Chronicle. In another sign that Japan is pressing ahead in revising its history of World War II, new high school textbooks will no longer acknowledge that the Imperial Army was responsible for a major atrocity in Okinawa, the government announced late Friday. The Ministry of Education ordered publishers to delete passages stating that the Imperial Army ordered civilians to commit mass suicide during the Battle of Okinawa, as the island was about to fall to American troops in the final months of the war. The decision was announced as part of the ministry's annual screening of all public school textbooks. The ministry also ordered changes to other delicate issues to dovetail with government assertions, even though the screening is supposed to be free of political interference. Quote, I believe the screening system has been followed appropriately, unquote, said Prime Minister Shinzo Abe, who has long campaigned to soften the treatment in textbooks of Japan's wartime conduct. And skipping down in the article about the substance of this controversy, Japan officially annexed Okinawa, a kingdom that to this day has retained some of its own culture, in the late 19th century. During World War II, when many Okinawans still spoke a different dialect, Japanese troops treated the locals brutally. In its history of the war, the Okinawa Prefectural Peace Memorial Museum presents Okinawa as being caught in the fighting between America and Japan, a starkly different view from Tokyo's Yasukuni Shrine War Museum, which presents Japan as a liberator of Asia from Western powers. During the 1945 battle, during which one quarter of the civilian population was killed, the Japanese army showed indifference to Okinawa's defense and safety. Japanese soldiers used civilians as shields against the Americans and convinced locals that victorious U.S. soldiers would go on a rampage of killing and raping. With the impending victory of U.S. troops, civilians committed mass suicide, urged on by fanatical Japanese soldiers. Quote, there were some people who were forced to commit suicide by the Japanese army, unquote, one old textbook explained. But in the revision ordered by the ministry, it now reads, there were some people who were driven to mass suicide, unquote. And the next article that we're going to look at is one from the Consortium News website, and we're going to be taking a look at an article by Jerry Meldon, really a book review by Jerry Meldon. Jerry Meldon is a Tufts professor, Tufts University in Massachusetts, and Jerry Meldon is also the fellow who translated the book The Great Heroin Coup by Henrik Krüger, a book familiar to the old listeners to this broadcast. And what Jerry Meldon is going to be talking about here is the fact that just as the Japanese textbooks are now officially reflecting the institutionalized lie that there was no atrocious activity by and a part of the Japanese on Okinawa, so too the refusal by Prime Minister Abe to acknowledge the comfort women and other similar aspects of World War II historical revisionism, one of the reasons that these are not going to be the subject of too much pressure from certainly the Bush administration and probably a great many other interests is that there are profound economic links between the Japanese fascists and elements in this country, something that dates back to the immediate post-World War I period. The Bush family are among the elements that have benefited from World War II Japanese loot, according to some of the broadcasts that we've covered. And why the Japanese are able to get away with that sort of historical revisionism is explained in the articles with which we're going to be concluding this broadcast. Again, sort of the price we pay for not having really won World War II is basically that we lose. This is from the Consortium News website. It's by Jerry Meldon, dated February 24th of 2007. Why the U.S. Shields Japan's World War II Denials. On February 19th, Japanese Foreign Minister Taro Aso took exception to a U.S. congressional resolution introduced by Representative Mike Honda, Democrat of California, calling on Japan, quote, to formally acknowledge, apologize, and accept historical responsibility, unquote, for coercing 200,000 Asian women into slavery as comfort women, wartime prostitutes for 3.5 million Japanese soldiers. Mr. Aso said he considers the accusation groundless and extremely regrettable. 6 decades after World War II, can it really be that Japanese officials are still distorting history and insulting the Chinese, Koreans, Filipinos, and others across Asia whom Hiroshito's forces savagely brutalized and robbed? And why does Washington turn a deaf ear? The answers may be rooted in what transpired behind closed doors in Tokyo when Japan was occupied by the U.S. military in the post-war years. Sterling and Peggy Seagrave suggest a motive in their eye-opening and at times stomach-churning 2003 book, Gold Warriors, America's Secret Recovery of Yamashita's Gold. In the war's immediate aftermath, General Douglas MacArthur, Commander-in-Chief of Allied Occupation Forces, secretly joined hands with Japanese war criminals. Rather than convict, imprison, and throw away the keys, MacArthur coddled those responsible for one of history's bloodiest wars of aggression. When the U.S. occupation ended in 1952, he released all those who were still in custody. And it may have gone a lot further than that. According to Gold Warriors, even as the United States, quote, introduced dramatic reforms and a new constitution, it put Japan back under the control of the men who were devoutly undemocratic, insisting that Japan never stole anything and was flat broke, when in reality America had given it huge infusions of black money. By the way, that black money or clandestine money, quote, black gold, unquote, fueled, among other things, the M Fund, and one of the people associated with the M Fund was former Prime Minister Tanaka, the grandfather of current Prime Minister Shinzo Abe, an example of why the apples are said to not fall too far from the tree. Continuing with the Jerry Meldon article, Washington even had Article 14 of the 1951 Japanese peace treaty state, quote, it is recognized that Japan should pay reparations to the Allied powers for the damage and suffering caused by it during the war. Nevertheless, it is also recognized that the resources of Japan are not presently sufficient. Therefore, the Allied powers waive all reparation claims of the Allied powers and their nationals arising out of any actions taken by Japan. Basically, that treaty negotiated by John Foster Dulles ruled out war reparations to the victims of Japanese war crimes, and they were profound. Again, the book Gold Warriors by Peggy and Sterling Seagraves and their previous volume, The Yamato Dynasty, both excellent books and, at least in the case of Gold Warriors, an essential book as well. Continuing with simply the recycling of the fascists in Japan or the fascists of the World War II period. As historian Christopher Simpson put it, the United States thereby ensured, quote, that the victims of the war, rape camp survivors, slave laborers, and POWs would be left with nothing, unquote. Furthermore, according to the Seagraves, records of Japan's looting and economic conspiracy have been removed from Western archives and databases, remain under secret classification, and will not be made public for another half century, unquote. The cover-up notwithstanding, the Seagraves somehow penetrated the veil of secrecy and reported on the source of the black money that MacArthur bestowed on the Japanese. They wrote that after arriving in Japan, the general's aides located $100 billion in gold, platinum, and other treasures that Hiroshito's forces had systematically plundered from occupied Asian nations and buried deep underground. When MacArthur reported this to Washington, President Harry S. Truman's brain trust, which included John McCloy, who as U.S. High Commissioner for Germany would authorize the early release of many Nazi war criminals, decided to devote the fortune to covert operations such as the bankrolling of rightist political parties and the recruitment of war criminals as U.S. intelligence agents for the Cold War that was just beginning. One of the most notorious crooks MacArthur embraced was Yakuza godfather Yoshio Kadama. With the exalted rank of Rear Admiral in the Japanese Navy, Kodama had overseen the wartime looting of Asia's criminal infrastructure. In the process, he stashed away a personal fortune estimated at $13 billion. Arrested as a Class A war criminal, he made a deal with MacArthur's intelligence chief, General Charles Willoughby. Kodama handed the CIA $100 million in return for his release from Sugamo Prison. Returning to the underworld, he regained control of the Asian heroin traffic. According to the Seagraves and others, he also remained a CIA asset until his death in 1984. It was apparently in that capacity that he became a major behind-the-scenes political force, primarily in Japan, but indirectly across the Pacific as well. Together with his fellow racketeer and Class A war criminal Roichi Sasakawa, Kodama underwrote the creation of two Japanese political parties that later combined to form the Liberal Democratic Party, or LDP, parenthetically, to which Shinzo Abe belongs. Continuing, except for a brief hiatus, when voters had had their fill of corruption, the conservative LDP has ruled Japan ever since. According to sources cited by the Seagraves, the LDP secretly contributed to the 1960 presidential campaign of Richard M. Nixon. The LDP was not the only organization which Kodama and Sasakawa bankrolled that lavished the gangsters' ill-begotten wealth on American politicians. They also underwrote the Reverend Sun Myung Moon's Unification Church, which owns the right-wing daily, The Washington Times, and which also, by the way, I would add, is tremendously influential in other capacities, dominating the sushi industry and having tremendous control or influence within the Bush administration. I would also note that the Bush family directly, according to a passage from Gold Warriors, were beneficiaries of a shipment of that World War II Japanese gold. By the way, in the article that we just read, the billions alluded to were billions in early 1940s dollars. That would be an astronomical sum in the contemporary period. Note also that there were golden lily stashes in other parts of the Pacific, and that most of the wealth that was looted by the Japanese was brought to the home islands and stashed there. And one of the things not discussed directly in that article is the fact that there were very profound, and are very profound, connections between corporate America and corporate Japan. And because of those investments, corporate America benefited from the war of aggression of corporate Japan and its military allies, and in turn, they wanted to recoup their investment at the end of World War II. And those Japanese business partners of their American counterparts used slave labor, benefited from illegal war loot, and by extension, their American cartel partners benefited as well. There are numerous broadcasts talking about Gold Warriors and about these relationships. I will note them in the description for the program. Some more about the recruitment of Japanese war criminals, in this case not to forge Japanese political life, but to conduct Japanese intelligence activities and CIA activities as well. This story is an AP story out of USA Today from February 22nd of 2007. It's by Joe Coleman of the Associated Press, headlined CIA Files Show How Post-War Spies Snookered U.S. Intelligence. And in this dynamic, there is a very important element here. Basically, although the U.S. thought they were being slick in hiring these fascists, whether Japanese fascists in this case, or the Italian fascists we covered in Side 2, or the German fascists that have been the focal point of so many broadcasts, the fact of the matter is we were hiring people who were determined to nail us, and we were basically being snookered. Ultimately, these political forces went about their own way. This article reads, Colonel Masanobu Tsuji, T-S-U-J-I, was a fanatical Japanese militarist and brutal warrior, hunted after World War II for massacres of Chinese civilians in complicity in the Bataan Death March. And then he became a U.S. spy. Newly declassified CIA records released by the U.S. National Archives and examined by the Associated Press document more fully than ever how Tsuji and other suspected Japanese war criminals were recruited by U.S. intelligence in the early days of the Cold War. The documents also show how ineffective the effort was in the CIA's view. The records, declassified in 2005 and 6 under an act of Congress in tandem with Nazi war crime-related files, fill in many of the blanks in the previously spotty documentation of the occupation authorities' intelligence arm and its involvement with Japanese ultranationalists and war criminals, historians say. In addition to Tsuji, who escaped Allied prosecution and was elected to Parliament in the 1950s, conspicuous figures in U.S.-funded operations included mob boss and war profiteer Yoshio Kunama and Takashiro Hattori, former private secretary to Hideki Tojo, the wartime prime minister, hanged as a war criminal in 1948. The CIA also cast a harsh eye on its counterparts and institutional rivals at G2, the occupation's intelligence arm, providing evidence for the first time that the Japanese operatives often built gullible American patrons, passing on useless intelligence and using their ties to boost smuggling operations and further their efforts to resurrect a militarist Japan. And a little bit about General Charles Willoughby, an individual that we've looked at before. By the way, Charles Willoughby ultimately became very close to, among others, Nelson Bunker Hunt. He was the fellow who formed the International Committee for the Defense of Christian Culture, a conspiratorial fascist milieu to which Bunker Hunt belonged. And Bunker Hunt, among others, has collaborated with, among others, Ali bin Musalim, who ran the special al-Qaeda account at Bank al-Taqwa. Skipping down in this article of Charles Willoughby, the informants, many of whom were held as war criminals after Tokyo's surrender and subsequently released, operated under the patronage of Major General Charles Willoughby, a German-born monocle-wearing admirer of Mussolini, a staunch anti-communist, and as the chief of G2 in the occupation government, considered second in power only to his boss, General Douglas MacArthur. And again, note that the head of intelligence, the second most powerful officer, at least according to that account, and by others, according to others I've read, was an admirer of Mussolini. In the book The Man Who Knew Too Much by Dick Russell, there's a tremendous amount of information about Willoughby, whom Russell believes to be circumstantially linked, probably a major figure in the assassination of President Kennedy. This crew, rather like some of the residual Nazi elements in Germany, attempted to stage a coup near the end of the Korean War. We've examined the Naumann coup plot in a number of broadcasts, including RFA 37. We've also looked at the Naumann plot in some of our conversations with Kevin Coogan, author of Dreamer of the Day. A similar coup plot was hatched by some of Willoughby's protégés in Japan. This from the Chronicle, the San Francisco Chronicle, of Thursday, March 1st of 2007, also by Joe Coleman of the Associated Press. Japan coup plot in 1952 is revealed. Declassified documents reveal that Japanese ultranationalists with ties to U.S. military intelligence plotted to overthrow the Japanese government and assassinate the Prime Minister in 1952. The scheme, which was abandoned, was concocted by militarists and war criminal suspects who had worked for U.S. occupation authorities after World War II, according to CIA records reviewed by the Associated Press. The plotters wanted a government that would rearm Japan. The CIA files, declassified in 2005 and publicized by the U.S. National Archives in January, detail a plot to oust pro-U.S. Prime Minister Shigeru Yoshida and install a more hawkish government led by Ichiro Hatoyama. The CIA, in papers released under an act of Congress to declassify documents related to Japanese war crimes, said the plotters were led by Takashiro Hattori, a former private secretary to Hideki Tojo, the wartime prime minister who was hanged as a war criminal in 1948. The files strongly suggest the Americans were unaware of the plot until after it had been dropped. The plot was developed after the U.S. post-war occupation of Japan ended in April of 1952, and the CIA files say American financial support for Hattori's group had dried up by then, but not the M Fund, I would ask. Note that the U.S. was largely unaware of that coup plot until after it had been dropped. Well, I would suggest they've been aware of an awful lot of other important things, including the Niger Yellowcake, which the rapacious, unqualifiedly rapacious, and oil-hungry Bush administration was only too happy to lap up like honey in the path of a marauding bear. We paid a high price for our continuation of collaboration with fascist elements. Let's hope that price doesn't continue to manifest itself. Do you want to know more? Check the Spitfire website, www.spitfirelist.com. There is literally a wealth of information about all of these subjects. I will make some suggestions, some concrete suggestions about where to go in the description for the Record program number 600, because this concludes side two of For the Record 600, The Axis Revisited, Changing the Past and Controlling the Present. This program is being recorded on June 10th of 2007. My name is Dave Emery. Thanks for listening.